Italy's borrowing costs have crossed a dangerous threshold. From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Jeremy Hobson's on assignment in New York today. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org on this Wednesday, November 9th. Coming up, how Italy's handling its own debt crisis. The country's got a bit of a food crisis as well. Here at home, justices of the Supreme Court are ready to decide whether they'll take up challenges to the president's health care reform law. And Red Sox fans, rejoice. Your team may have choked in September, but come next year, you'll pay the same price for tickets. Those stories ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Interest rates on Italian bonds have reached a mark that economists worry about. The yield on 10-year Italian debt is now above 7%, which could make the country's debt next to impossible to pay back. Already, the Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi is poised to step down after the country implements economic reforms. Guy Dinmore is the Italian correspondent for the Financial Times newspaper. He's with us now from Rome. Hey there, Guy.
Good morning.
I know with the Prime Minister stepping down, the cost to borrow has still gone up into what some are saying is an unsustainable level. I mean, what does the government and the Italian economy do now?
Yes, the markets are truly panicking, and this has shocked the entire political establishment here, who thought the deal last night whereby the Prime Minister, Silvio Berlusconi, would resign would be enough to appease the markets. There's now a great concentration in the minds of everyone in Italy to pass this reform legislation as quickly as possible, which would then be followed by Mr. Berlusconi's resignation. The trouble is that he is pressing for elections to follow, and the markets are completely spooked by the idea of several months of paralysis and no action and an uncertain outcome, and would much prefer that Italy had an emergency government in place, possibly led by a technocrat from outside parliament who would try and restore market confidence.
I know we have market reaction and government reaction. What are people on the street saying?
It's very mixed. A lot of people are very skeptical that Berlusconi will carry out his promise to resign once these reform measures are passed. I think there's quite a lot of doubt and confusion in the streets, which mirrors what's going on within political circles.
Financial Times Italian correspondent Guy Dinmore in Rome. Guy, thank you.
My pleasure.
The head of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, is in Beijing today asking the Chinese government to step in and do some buying of European debt, since so many others will probably shy away. Marketplace China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports.
While the developed world is down in the dumps, China's economy continues to shine, which might explain Lagarde's gloomy speech today in front of her Chinese counterparts.
We believe that the world economy has entered a dangerous and uncertain phase.
Lagarde said the global economy is on the verge of a lost decade. She even set up an account on China's version of Twitter to spread her message.
It's possible that Lagarde is engaging in some gamesmanship to try and get the Chinese to up the ante a little bit.
Beijing economist Arthur Krober says Lagarde will have to do her best to show the Chinese that the European debt crisis is a crisis for China, too.
It's purely a question of how persuasive she is about the scale of the problem and to what extent the Chinese believe that their own economy runs on a different track.
So why should Beijing bail out Europe when European banks are running away? Exports, says Krober. China still sells more exports to the EU than any other market. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Worries about the Eurozone debt crisis, along with the sluggish American economy, has brought global growth to a near standstill. That, of course, means fewer goods are being traded. And this morning, the world's biggest container shipping line, Maersk, is posting losses of nearly $300 million for the past 3 months. Reporter Christopher Wirth has more from London.
Shipping, that is, the amount of stuff the world schleps from port to port, isn't just a good indicator of where the economy is now. It also tells us a lot about where we thought we'd be 3 years into recovery. After demand fell off a cliff in 2009, shipping companies ordered a slew of new container ships, expecting growth to be moving along by now. Instead, demand is nowhere near the level needed to keep up with the growing supply of cargo holds. Over 200 new vessels have hit the water so far this year. Steve Matthews of the Lloyd's List Shipping Journal says with all that competition, shippers have had to drop freight rates, which hurts their bottom lines.
Well, clearly there was a lot of over-optimism as to economic growth, and the order book of new container ships is still very large, and so there'll be a lot more delivered next year as well.
He says that means the shipping industry can expect plunging profits to continue into next year and maybe beyond. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
Some good news today from the Mortgage Bankers Association on the housing front. Applications for home mortgages shot up last week thanks to increased demand for loan refinancing. General Motors said today it made money for the seventh straight quarter in a row. And even though the numbers were down a bit, GM's earnings did beat Wall Street expectations.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
Today, a Senate panel is looking at the country's transportation infrastructure and how to pay for rebuilding it. Now, parts of the plan, maybe surprisingly, have bipartisan support, something that seems all too rare in Washington these days. So why are lawmakers willing to come together on transportation spending? Marketplace's David Gura is with us now from Washington with the latest. Hey, David.
Morning, Steve.
What exactly are Democrats and Republicans starting to agree on here?
Well, a couple of things, at least. Certainly that infrastructure in this country is not in the greatest shape, that roads and bridges need to be repaired and replaced. Many Democrats and Republicans agree the federal government could do more to encourage states to avoid putting money in the same old construction projects and instead fund some that reduce congestion and air pollution, among other things. I talked to Emil Frankel this morning, Steve. He's a transportation expert at the Bipartisan Policy Center.
The wish and the desire is there, but I'm not sure that the means is yet there for tackling this problem.
Now, they're fighting over how to fund this plan. Right now, states are prohibited from putting tolls on the interstate. Some lawmakers would like to see that ban lifted. So, Steve, that's just one of many points that needs to be resolved for both sides to come to an agreement on how to pay for a transportation plan.
All right, David, so there are debates about the budget and how to pay for it, but would the plan create any jobs?
Right. Well, this idea of infrastructure sort of paving a path to better employment is something we've heard over and over again. Robert Puentes is with the Brookings Institution. He says there is evidence a good transportation plan could do that.
We know that the multipliers that come through the spending that goes for things like transportation don't just benefit projects in the short term. There are other kind of indirect benefits.
So, yes, this could create jobs for construction workers and folks in manufacturing. And, Steve, reducing the time workers spend in their cars, that has economic benefits, too.
All right. Marketplace's David Gura reporting from our Washington Bureau. David, thanks.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, U.S. Supreme Court justices will decide whether to hear legal challenges to President Obama's health care reform law. A politically contentious debate's been raging up to now, and Marketplace's Gregory Warner is with us now from the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia. Good morning, Gregory.
Hey there, Steve.
So now, what's at issue here?
Well, the individual mandate is a requirement that all Americans buy insurance if they don't have it already. And this would start in 2014. It's a huge deal. 30 million people would be eligible off the bat, and there'd be big subsidies for those who can't afford it.
So what's at stake then for health insurance companies if the courts get rid of the mandate?
Well, the poor insurance industry, right? We need some violin music here. But let's take their side for a second, because there's this thing that insurers dread. It's called adverse selection. It's a fancy name for selling policies to too many sick people, basically. And that's bad for profits, because if they have more healthy people on their books, you know, they make money.
Yeah.
Now, the healthcare reform law puts all kinds of new restrictions on insurance companies. So they no longer can deny you for a pre-existing condition, that is, for being sick. They can't trick you with fine print that disqualifies you when you get sick. They have to let dependents under age 26 on your plan, even if your kid is sick. All this gives you and I more leverage to buy insurance when we need it. Randy Boberg at the Urban Institute says the individual mandate gets rid of this leverage by forcing everyone to buy insurance, even if they're healthy.
If you leave in place most of the reform and you get rid of the mandate, you increase the incentive to go uninsured, because you know if you ever need it, you can just sign on the dotted line and get it.
And that's the nightmare that keeps CEOs of insurance companies up at night.
All right. So is it possible then that the Supreme Court could get rid of the individual mandate to keep in place the rest of the law?
It's very possible. And the states and the Small Business Association leading this lawsuit say that, well, without the mandate, there's no law, that it would be like a de facto repeal. Now, the White House makes a pretty convincing argument that that's not entirely true. Yes, some pieces of the law, like the restrictions on insurance companies that I mentioned, those would fall. But this is a big law. You know, there's lots in it, whole sections on how doctors get paid and other things that would not be going away.
All right. Marketplace's Gregory Werner. Thanks, Gregory.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, a lot of people will be doing a lot of shopping over the course of the next 6 or 7 weeks. But forget the mall this holiday season. Shopping now is all about the wall. Retailers like Walmart and Sears are testing so-called shopping walls across the country. And they let shoppers make purchases with their cell phones. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more.
I checked out a Sears shopping wall at a movie theater in New York. It's a poster covered with photos of toys, like Hot Wheels and Let's Rock Elmo. Each picture has a quick response, or QR code, next to it. You know, those ubiquitous black and white squares? If you take a photo of that square with your smartphone, it will whisk you to a website where you can buy that item.
The convenience factor of this is really exciting.
Marketing consultant Tracy Chapman says shopping walls are popping up in bus stops, subways, movie theaters, places where people have time to kill. Making shopping easy and fast is paramount these days. After all, the faster you buy, the less time you have to think about your budget.
Retailers who can make it a fun experience and bring back the fun of the shop are the ones that are going to win with consumers.
I scanned and re-scanned the QR codes, but my cell reception in the movie theater wasn't good enough to connect me to any of the product pages. Looks like I'll be fighting it out at the mall after all. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Well, of course, we're counting up all the votes today after an election day full of ballot measures and local and state races. Voters in Ohio repealed the state's new law limiting collective bargaining rights for unionized state workers. That was a big thing on the ballot yesterday in Ohio. And elections always get us thinking about voting with the almighty dollar. Of course, that adage means Americans can vote at specific times of the year with their ballots, but we all make decisions about what to buy every day. So in today's Midday Extra, we ask, do Democrats and Republicans, or independents too, do they like the same companies? And for the second year in a row, YouGov's Brand Index measured the most popular U.S. brands for Democrats, Republicans, and independents. And here to talk with us about that survey and what it means is Ted Marzilli, who is Global Managing Director of Brand Index. Hey, Ted.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. How did you come up with this idea?
Well, we have our roots in political polling at YouGov. Leading up to Election Day every year, we think about what could be a fun way to look at the data that we collect. We track 1,100 brands on a daily basis, and we thought it would be fun to look at how Democrats, Republicans, and Independents rate those brands and if there's much variance across those three groups.
How on earth do you get this data? I mean, when you're in the checkout aisle, you're not like checking off whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. I mean, how do you know?
Yeah, there's a couple of different ways that we get this information. One is we are a polling organization and a market research firm. So we have 1.5 million people, consumers across the U.S., who have agreed to participate in research for us. And we ask them all sorts of questions about themselves, including whether or not they consider themselves to be Democrats, independents, or Republicans. Separately, we run a brand index survey. We do this every day, where we interview 5,000 consumers, a representative sample of the U.S. population 18 and over, and we ask them their opinions on brands. So we're able to combine those two data sets, if you will, the brand scores, with the folks who tell us what their political leanings are, and then look at the data by those political groups.
All right. So soft drinks, you know, do Democrats like different kinds of soft drinks than Republicans do, or?
Well, you typically see that there's a lot of commonality between Republicans and Democrats. So brands like Coca-Cola and Pepsi are going to be at the top of the list for both sets. What's really interesting is when you start to see what some of the differences are. So for the second year in a row, Google was the number one brand rated by Democrats, but it doesn't appear on the Republican top 10 list.
Google.
So you can think that that might be due to the political leanings of the founders, who have been known to host Democratic fundraisers.
That's interesting, yeah. But,
you know, Google has also more recently, I believe on September 27th of this year, sponsored a Republican debate that was aired on Fox. So whether or not the brand is consciously trying to appeal to the right, if you will, or not, is not really clear.
Give us some surprises on brands that maybe you didn't think either party or independents would use.
You know, when you look at these brands that we track, they are some of the most well-known brands in America, right? So brands like Cheerios, you wouldn't expect those to come off as particularly Democratic or Republican. And in fact, they're on both lists and they even make the independent list. And when you think about most brands, they're probably not intentionally positioning themselves as Republican or Democrat. So we expect to see a lot of commonality across the lists. And in fact, we do. So it's really those brands that appear on one list and not the other that call attention to themselves. So we mentioned Google on the Democratic side. Amazon moved up this year to be the number two brand among Democrats. Again, it doesn't appear on the Republican list. So those are sort of interesting contrasts. And whether that means that Democrats are more technology savvy or open to technology, or if it says something more about the founders of those companies and how they are perceived to lean with their politics, you can't say with certainty. But we can say that Democrats rate those brands more highly than Republicans.
I dare ask, Ted, what do we do with this information? I mean, where does it go?
Well, I think there's a few reasons why this information is important. One is, as I mentioned, most brands are probably trying to appeal to the broadest possible consumer set possible. So it may come as a surprise to them that they might be viewed better or worse by Republicans or Democrats, and they may want to use information like this to start to investigate why their brand is perceived better by one group than the other and possibly make amends. The second thing that this information is helpful with, you know, if you remember about a year ago, Target, the big retailer, mm-hmm. made a political donation to a political action committee in Minnesota. That political action committee supported a gubernatorial candidate who was not in favor of same-sex marriage. And that triggered a pretty big protest by the gay and lesbian community. So as corporations have more freedom to donate to political campaigns, they may face some consequences when those political donations come to light. And data like this, again, can start to tease out whether or not those political leanings of companies are helping or hurting the brand. A third way that the data can be used is by politicians themselves. It might be very interesting if you're a politician to know which brands are viewed as more Republican or Democrat, and then think about if you have to stage a press release, do you want to do that in front of a brand that's more highly regarded by Republicans or Democrats or the people that you consider to be your constituents?
What are you saying? Like if you're having a press conference, you have a Coca-Cola there in front of you or good product placement?
It could be that, or if, you know, if you're going to introduce your program on jobs, do you want to be announcing that in the parking lot of a Walmart or a Kmart or a Target? So things like that can start to play a role in how politicians start to make decisions and subconsciously help voters connect products that they love with the politicians that they hope those voters will vote for.
Well, it's pretty interesting stuff. And I know, Ted, we've got a chart of the top 10 brands for each political affiliation at our website, marketplace.org. Ted Marzilli joining us this morning from YouGov's Brand Index. Ted, thank you so much.
You bet. Thanks a lot.
We told you earlier about the super high interest rates on Italian bonds, what some have described as a Vulcanian or Herculean disaster in the making for Italy. But there's also an Epicurean catastrophe that's befallen that country. Trouble with Italy's beloved white truffles. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrian Hill reports.
White truffle, the pungent delicacy, pairs well with lots of things. Risotto, eggs, but not this summer's hot weather.
And that usually doesn't go really well with truffle, especially the white Alba truffle, which will tend to like better some sort of colder, cooler weather.
Vincent Jean-Somme is the vice president of importer Sabatino Truffles in New York. He says the harvest is down and the retail cost is up. Reports range from 20% to 100% over last year. It's a lucrative market, and it's got other farmers looking to grow their own truffles in places like Oregon, China, and Croatia. Piero Salvaggio owns Valentino Restaurant in Santa Monica, California.
As you say, yes, you have Oregon truffles, Chinese truffles, and Croatian truffles, but they are not the real McCoy.
I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
And finally, Boston Red Sox fans, breathe a sigh of relief. Your ticket prices will not go up next year. The club said this week publicly available seat prices will stay the same for the second time in 4 years. Was it team owners feeling really generous to loyal fans? Could be, could be. Was it the fact the Red Sox won only 7 games out of 20 in September and lost their manager and their general manager at about the same time? Yeah, that's part of the reason, too. As a matter of fact, the team officially identified the September meltdown as, quote, trying times. I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles. Thanks for being with us. Enjoy your Wednesday. This is the Marketplace Midday Update. And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.